One.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX-AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on Long Island Sound. It can be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest today is Professor Donald M. Goldstein of the University of Pittsburgh. Our subject today on the 70th anniversary of the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor are the revisionist myths about the attack on Pearl Harbor. As I say each week, the mission of the advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow to that end. Many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Professor Goldstein, to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Glad to be there.
Thank you. Professor Donald Goldstein is a retired Air Force officer who served for 22 years in the American Armed Forces. He's currently a professor emeritus of public and international affairs at the Graduate School of Pittsburgh, involving public and international affairs. He has been involved in the Air War College, the Air Command and Staff College, the University of Tampa, Troy State University, and of course, University of Pittsburgh. He's a former associate dean at Pittsburgh. He's currently on the faculties of Asian Studies, Eastern European, Western European, and Honors Program at the University of Pittsburgh. He's the author of over 70 articles and 27 books. His most famous is At Dawn We Slept, The Untold Story of Pearl Harbor, which is in at least its 20th printing. The book was first runner-up for the Pulitzer Prize in 1982 and was on the New York Times bestseller list for 47 weeks. His book, Miracle at Midway, was on the bestseller list for 9 weeks. He's in co-authored with associates and, of course, involved with the famous and late Gordon Prang, who did tremendous amount of notes on Pearl Harbor for 35 years. December 7th, Pearl Harbor, The Verdict of History, and many other books, Target Tokyo, the story of the Sword Spy Ring, and a various long history in and a long interest in history, especially the war in the Pacific. Professor Goldstein's averaged over 200 talks a year, TV and civic organizations. He's been awarded 2 Peabody Awards for his work on Pearl Harbor, 2 Hours That Changed the World with David Brinkley, and D-Day, A Soldier Story with the late Peter Jennings on ABC. In addition to his PhD from the University of Denver, Dr. Goldstein holds a Bachelor of Art and 3 master's degrees and is a graduate of the Air Command and Staff College. He is also a consultant for ABC, NBC, the Discovery Channel, etc. He and his wife, Marion, now live in Florida. You know, on December 7th, 1941, the American naval base located at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and the anchorage of its Pacific Fleet was attacked by the forces of the Imperial Japanese Navy commanded by Admiral Yamamoto. The next day, shortly after noon on Monday, December 8, 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt stood at the podium in a joint session of Congress and stated to the assembled and hushed members, "Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan." Professor Goldstein, could you set the stage of what happened that day 70 years ago?
Well, it was in Hawaii, every day is the same. Yesterday is like today, and tomorrow is like yesterday. And the fleet had been on alert several weeks, off and on, and that the week before they'd had a big alert, and that particular Sunday they weren't ready. And there were a lot of instances of this. I have a lot of reasons for this. One is, you know, it's kind of like a fire drill. When I'm in school, I use this analogy of it's good, and they have these drills, and eventually I don't go out, and the day I don't go out is the day I get hit. Mm. And so it was a very complacent day there, and we were caught unawares, and there were a lot of reasons that we can go into in a few minutes.
Yeah. You know, since that day, controversy, guilt, blame, and revisionist history have abounded. Could you describe the mood of the country in the wake of the attack and our subsequent feelings of inadequacy?
Well, in America in those days, we were ranked 19th in the world between Yugoslavia and Bulgaria. Our army was not very well prepared. We didn't have the proper weapons. they used broomsticks. People told me this, so I know. They used broomsticks as guns. They had jeeps with signs on them. This is a tank. We were not very well, and we didn't care. These were the days of we were still in the Depression. There were people trying to get out of the Depression. This was the Lindbergh deal was still heavy in everybody's mind. There was a communist scare by a fellow named Palmer, just a little bit before Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. It was Long Way Corrigan, Shipwreck Kelly, Jada Jada Jing Jing Jing. This was the days of Jolting Joe DiMaggio, 57 consecutive games he hit, 406 for Ted Williams. We weren't ready for this, and a lot of people didn't want war. We'd kind of gone to one war, World War One, and what did we get out of it? George M. Cohan singing "I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy." I mean, seriously, people didn't want war. There were a lot of peace activists. Lindbergh himself was an advocate against war anywhere. We had a lot of peace movements going on, American Firsters going on, and we just didn't want to get involved in Europe. We had our own problems here.
And after the attack, there was a lot of guilt and feeling of recrimination and inadequacy. How did that manifest itself?
Well, you know, we're winners. God bless us. We're winners. America's a winner, and we don't like to lose. And when you lose, then we get into the blame game. You know, and people like revisionism. It sells books. It's good stuff. It makes people think, and from that point of view, it is good. But, you know, Elvis is still alive. Johnny Kennedy's a vegetable somewhere. Amelia Earhart. We have to put the blame game. Instead of saying, hey, you know, we were unaware, we had 9 investigations to tell us what we knew. We just got caught sleeping. A good example that the people in New York can understand would be 9/11. 9/11 and Pearl Harbor are very much the same in terms of woulda, coulda, shoulda, and putting the blame on somebody. In the final analysis, they caught us asleep. But yet, people don't want to say that, so you have to blame. It's Roosevelt's fault. It's George Bush's, not George Bush, but whoever at that time it is, George Bush's fault. We've got to blame people. Mm. And consequently, we get into that mode, and it's really bad. Instead of saying, how do we prevent something, we want to, you know, we want to blame somebody.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
There was enough of that going on. There were 9 investigations on this thing, and the key one was the congressional one. There was an investigation the day after Frank Knox, the Secretary of the Navy, the Republican in a Democratic administration, goes out to Pearl Harbor and starts his investigation. There was an Army investigation, a Navy investigation, there were several private investigations, and of course the big one was the Congress. But the key to this is we had broken their code, and we couldn't talk about some things during these investigations till after the war, because we didn't want to let these people know that we knew what they were doing.
Sure. You know, the Japanese military was generally viewed by the Western powers, and ourselves included, as inadequate to compete with Western power, technology, and physical ability. Most Americans, including the top military leaders, did not believe the Japanese were capable of inflicting any discernible damage on an American battle fleet. Professor Goldstein, how did that view become so pervasive?
Well, first, there's a lot of racism on both sides of this. The Japanese couldn't possibly see good enough to fly airplanes. Their eyes were slanted. They didn't have the balance. Their babies, when they were babies, they were carried on their mother's back. They were small, little, and I hate to use this word, but we will because it's politically correct then. They were Japs, and we saw them as either little men too small to do this, or these big wrestlers, these sumi wrestlers from the Reader's Digest. Hardly many people didn't even know where Japan was. And things that were made in Japan, if I might add that, were bad. They fell apart. We used to laugh about it. I mean, it was junk, pure junk. And so how could this country do this? How could they go 5,000, 6,000 miles across the ocean and not be seen? They couldn't. They couldn't pull off an attack. We didn't have the torpedo. How could they have one that didn't sink in the mud? How could they have a bomb, which they developed, to go 6 decks down into a battleship and do heavy damage? How did they have aircraft carriers? Well, the battleship was the queen of the Navy in those days. Teddy Roosevelt had started this. How could they have... they couldn't sink battleships. I mean, Billy Mitchell did it once, but the ships were in the harbor in Hampton Roads, and nobody could do this. So we didn't think, we couldn't do it, therefore they couldn't do.
You know, you quoted Congressman James O. Scruggum of Nevada, who said at Pearl Harbor was sounded the death knell of leadership of false prophets who, under the delusions of keeping us out of war, would have stopped preparations for defense, and who chorused with Lindbergh that we should make friends with Germany, the probable winner of the conflict. Gone or quiescent are the influences that feared to offend Japan and encourage their vast imports of war materials from the United States. A costly and tragic lesson has been given us. Did others also start to understand the failure of isolationism, the American first appeasement, and the lack of defense spending by a recalcitrant Congress?
Wow, you hit it pretty hard. But they were, yes. But, you know, the people that don't want war, and that's good, that war's bad, let's be honest, are the ones that seem to make the most noise in these kinds of times. And we were short on money. The draft had passed. 213 to 212 with 17 abstentions. This was during the warm-up to the war. He's right to a lot of degree there, that there were people like George Marshall and others that said we got to keep the defense strong, but that was far from our mind then. We'd just gotten out of the war. It was a short time. It's only 20 years between World War One and World War Two. We didn't want any part of it. Hitler was marching. That's another story, of course. From 1939 to 41, Hitler is marching. He's taken, he's beat France. He's got almost all of Europe. We're doing nothing. And we're doing nothing because we didn't want to get involved. George Washington, I guess, said it best in his first speech, stay out of European entanglements.
And of course, and we'll probably get into this a bit later, but when Franklin Roosevelt made his quarantine speech in 1937 about quarantining the totalitarians and the dictators, over 400 newspapers called for his impeachment the next day. So you could understand that Roosevelt, who was warning on this, who was talking about this, had to tread very lightly. I just want to mention my guest is Professor Donald M. Goldstein, Professor Emeritus of the University of Pittsburgh. Our subject today is the 70th anniversary of the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. And we're talking about the revisionist myths about the attack, sneak attack on this day. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460 and live streaming on WVOX.com. Professor Goldstein is, of course, the author with the great former Gordon Prang and Kathleen Dillon of the immensely popular and respected At Dawn We Slept. Not long, Professor Goldstein, after the withdrawal of the Japanese fleet from Hawaiian waters, the Philippines were attacked, and all over the Pacific, Imperial Japanese forces were on the move. Within a day or so, the British battleship and heavy cruiser Prince of Wales and Repulse were sunk by Japanese planes, and the United States was in emotional chaos. When did these inquiries, you mentioned this a little earlier, when did these inquiries start regarding the culpability of Admiral Husband Kimmel and General Walter Short, the Navy and Army commanders? When did that proceed? Almost immediately?
The next day.
Next day.
Yeah, you know, and in New York, it's funny that in the New York Times that day, there was a headline, you can look it up. It said the American fleet is second to none in the world. Henry Knox had said this. And it's funny that I could add a little caveat here on the bottom of the ocean, you know. But let's go back to something I think that's important for your listeners. I'm not going to change anybody's mind. Roosevelt, I know this from going out in the field, Roosevelt was a pretty much hated man in the Midwest. He was the father of cultural social security and socialism, etc. But to think of a conspiracy theory, let me go through this real fast. It wasn't Roosevelt that told the aircraft carriers to go out to sea so that they weren't there, so they couldn't be hit. It was the Kimmel and Short. It wasn't Roosevelt that opened the harbor up, the nets. It was the people at Pearl Harbor. It wasn't Roosevelt that warned, that was warned twice by Martin and Bellinger, the two air people out there at Pearl Harbor, and then do anything. It wasn't Roosevelt that spotted an airplane in the sky 2 hours before the attack and didn't do anything. It wasn't Roosevelt that that changed the code from 1 to 3 so that the people in Washington thought that they were on one alert and they were really on sabotage alert. It wasn't Roosevelt that lined the planes up bumper to bumper so that you could take a bowling ball and shoot them all up in the field because he was afraid of sabotage. It wasn't Roosevelt that picked up airplanes on the radar and didn't do anything. It wasn't Roosevelt that sunk a ship in the harbor 1 hour before and still nothing was done. So it's a comedy of a lot of errors. Yes, he's in charge, but the people out there were really in charge, and they really failed. That's hard to convince people of that because, you know, we just don't like to do that. But to have a conspiracy like these people want, you'd have to implicate George Marshall, Nobel Prize winner, Marshall Plan, Secretary of State later on, Paragon of Virtue. You'd have to implicate the guys at Pearl Harbor, which they tried to do. You'd have to implicate Henry Knox, a Republican of Democratic administration, Henry Stimson, who was sober, the Secretary of War, who was so virtuous that in 1920s, when he heard we'd broken the Japanese code, said, "Gentlemen, don't read other people's mail."
Right.
I could go on and on, but right. I wanted to make that point that you get this conspiracy, but then nobody looks at the real facts.
Well, you summed it up very quickly, and I want to go through also a quick just a review on these inquiry boards. Now, these inquiry boards, there was a Supreme Court inquiry board led by Justice Owen Roberts. There were a number of them. What were the immediate conclusions, and why was there and I think you did bring up the most critical fact about magic, and explain a little bit about magic and what they feared for in these inquiries.
We had broken the Japanese code, the diplomatic code, and so we were reading their messages. In fact, when the bombs were falling, the guy at the Japanese embassy was supposed to deliver this message 1 hour before the attack, but he was a typist like I am, and so he was punching one word, so he was doing a very bad job, and so they got there and the bombs were already falling. And this always bothered the Japanese, I tell you this ahead of time, because it was in the Japanese culture, you kick the guy when he's sleeping, and then you wake him up, and then you kill him, and we didn't do that, and so they felt that... They let themselves down in that aspect. But given all that, we were reading their messages. Now, we were not reading their military code. We didn't do that till in April, JN-25 code, until April or May of 1942, which was in time to win the Battle of Midway in June of 42. People have said that they were broadcasting, and this is the whole revision of school, that they were broadcasting, the Japanese were coming across the ocean. But if you read our book and you read other books, and actually I interviewed Genda, who planned the attack, Fuchida, who led the attack, and they swear, and I asked them when these revisionists came out, "Look, did you break radio silence?" And they claimed no. And I said, "Well, you know, tell me, what difference does it make? You were successful." No, they didn't. So therefore, if they didn't break radio silence, the whole concept of us intercepting their messages is false. But people still say that did, and some prominent authors have come out and said that we were picking them up and tracking them and all that. So one, we had broken their code, their diplomatic, but two, we hadn't broken their military. But during 1943 and 4, we had, so we knew everything they were going to do, and that was the reason we really won the war. We knew what they were going to do. Same thing in Germany. We'd broken their code.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and of course you mentioned, and it's a later reflection you give about Miracle at Midway, and of course our ingenuity at luring the Japanese into describing the breakdown of water conversion facilities at Midway enabled the American forces to pinpoint that. But it's interesting because with all this speculation and, you know, mysticism that goes on, and I think you described it quite well earlier about this idea that people get involved with conspiracies and enjoy them, it is obvious that we knew that war was coming. It is also obvious that this is a big Atlantic, a big Pacific Ocean, and there were concerns whether it was the attack was going to be in, you know, China or the Philippines or the west coast of the United States or Hawaii. And what is forgotten is that the American commanders at Pearl Harbor were on war alert.
You know, you did something there very good. I really mean this. people forget that the Atlantic Ocean is a lake, and the Pacific Ocean is really an ocean. I mean, this is a big thing. And in America, most of the people in those days came over on the ships, and they came through your town, Ellis Island there. And they came through there, and we were always European-oriented. So we really wanted to, if we wanted to go to war, we wanted to save Europe. Even today, we're European-oriented, yet the action is in India, the action is in China, and, you know, that's where the population is, that's where you could make your money, but it's always been that way. And so we saw Europe as a place that if we want to fight, that's where we wanted to fight. We didn't want to fight in the Pacific. It's a vast ocean. In fact, we started taking ships out of the Pacific and put them into the Atlantic area just before the attack on Pearl Harbor, about 3 or 4 months before. So we really, really, and you're right on this, when the attack came, we thought, and Secretary Simpson says this, you mean they hit the Philippines, don't you? No, they hit Pearl Harbor. We didn't know this. We were tracking them, and we thought they were going to hit the Philippines, and they did. And the guys in the Philippines had 8 hours' notice, General Douglas MacArthur, of course, and he wasn't ready. In fact, he should have been hung, but I guess they couldn't do that. He was too big at that time, the name, and you needed heroes, and et cetera. So you're absolutely correct. This is the big thing. Our military is small. We can't guard everything, and we were thinking of the Atlantic. Now, for the revisionists, and this is very, very important, they forget. Yes, we wanted to get into the war. Yes, we wanted to do it against Germany. But the Japanese hit us, and we would have gone after them except for one thing. Hitler did us a favor by declaring war. It's Hitler that declares war to the United States, not the United States on Hitler.
That's right, on December 10th. And it's also interesting that when, you know, we reflect on this, and you mentioned earlier about torpedoes coming from an airplane. Ford Island, where the battleships were located, was quite shallow. And it's interesting that the revisionists and people talk about how the Japanese planned this for 10 years. Of course, they really didn't, because until the British used their antiquated fairy swordfish torpedo bombers and were able to defeat and sink half of the Italian fleet at Taranto, nobody even thought that was possible, and the Japanese created a shallow water torpedo.
That's true. Pearl Harbor is only 35 to 40 feet deep, and so they had to get a torpedo that would run shallow and run straight in water, and most torpedoes would sink in the mud.
Right.
In fact, that's why we had the nets up at Pearl Harbor, because we didn't think we had to keep them down. We wanted for the ships to be able to sail if they had to go. We were fortunate. Admiral Nimitz, who succeeded and was a hero of the war, really, in the Pacific, said that it's lucky we were at Pearl Harbor rather than at a place called Lahaina over in Maui, which is 400 feet deep, 350,
right.
400 feet deep, because when they hit us at Pearl Harbor, of all the ships that were sunk, only two were not raised.
Right.
That were the Utah, which is a semi-memorial of 60 people, 65 people still dead. And the Arizona, which has over 900 bodies still on it, because the people ask me why. Well, bones, well, you didn't have DNA in those days. And those two were the only two not raised. Every other ship at Pearl Harbor lived to fight another day.
Yeah. And we're going to get into that in a second, of course, Professor Goldstein. My guest today is Professor Donald M. Goldstein, the University of Pittsburgh. Our subject today is the 70th anniversary of the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. And we're talking about the revisionist myths about the attack on this vital naval base that thrust us into the Second World War. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX.com. You know, John T. Flynn, Charles Beard, Harry Elmer Barnes were early critics of the official history regarding the attack on Pearl Harbor. These three groups were represented by these positions. Roosevelt, foreign policy mistakes because America's participation in the war ultimately worked to the benefit of the Soviet Union. This thesis was adopted by William Newman and William Henry Chamberlain. They ignored the fact that the USA had to deal with the immediate danger of the Berlin-Rome-Tokyo axis and could not operate on the basis of what
than a problematical future menace. Charles Beard, the respected historian, believed that FDR maneuvered the U.S. into war, but he merely insinuated rather than stated outright that FDR knew about the Pearl Harbor attack in advance. And the last spearhead of the third revisionist school was the sociologist and historian Harry Elmer Barnes. He believed to get around FDR's campaign promise that he would not lead the U.S. into war unless it was attacked, the president and most of his top military and political advisors schemed to maneuver Japan into striking. Can you imagine this? They brought all these people into conspiracy to have our ships destroyed. Barnes postulated that Pearl Harbor must not be alerted, hence FDR and Marshall acting alone arranged such a warning to be withheld. Professor Goldstein, is this just flummery? Are any of these claims valid, or where does this come out of?
Well, you know, people, it's the same thing today, and I'm right-wing, so I said that they do with Obama, as they do with other people that are against something, then conceive ideas or plans that the president is bad, that he wants to do this or he wants to do that. And so this is the way it happens, and they really believed it. The thing about what they didn't understand is that the Japanese had their own mind, that the Japanese were coming, and that Roosevelt, if he knew it, could have told them one day before or a day before that it was coming. Because after all, if you're 200 miles away, 100 miles, what's the Japanese fleet doing a couple hundred miles away? You know what I mean? They're not there for, you know, to look at.
Fishing.
So even if one American dies, we go crazy. You know that.
Right.
That's our big weakness. It's a good weakness, human life. And therefore, the Japanese didn't have to have a big, successful attack. All they had to do was bomb a place like Pearl Harbor, and that would have meant war. But a lot of people don't believe that. And what we've done is we tried to find something that said, "Dear Joe, the Japanese are coming. Let them come. Sign Frank." We couldn't find anything. It's woulda, coulda, shoulda, musta, and it's all based on, you could say that's logical, but it's not true. I mean, we can't find anything, and we've been looking for this years, and it may be, for those out there that believe this, when the British open their files up in 75 years, so they have to wait, there may be something in there that Churchill knew, but right now, we just couldn't find this, and to have the country's too dumb, you're going to have somebody who's going to rat. You know, Roosevelt's allegedly son-in-law did this.
Curtis Dahl, yes.
You don't have anybody that can do that.
Well, it's interesting because it seems to be ideologically motivated. Most of these conspiracy theories, whether it's the idea that we never landed on the moon, that this was done in Hollywood, you know, 8% of the people believe that. Area 51 in New Mexico about the little green men. You know, we have all sorts of things. You know, the naval commander at Pearl Harbor, Admiral Husband Kimmel, who spent a lifetime, I think he lived till his 90s, and was trying to have himself exonerated. The Congress passed all sorts of, you know, pardons, etc. He claimed that surprise at Pearl Harbor was due not to any lack of responsible action on his own, rather than Roosevelt administration withheld information from. Is this claim realistic? And wasn't he instructed to be on alert for action in the Pacific in late November?
Two things on that. One, he was... the people in Washington, there were these machines, these magic machines. There were nine of them. The British had four or five of them. There was one in the Philippines, there was one in Frisco. There wasn't one at Pearl Harbor, and it probably should have been, which then would have maybe alerted him to action. But he was being kept up. He was told November 26th, I could do this off the top of my head, this is a war warning message. We're tracking the Japanese. They're coming down the Kwa Malay Peninsula. Be prepared. Don't harm or don't threaten or scare the people on the homeland, but be prepared for war. And you know, he misinterpreted this. Maybe you actually get ready for sabotage and not this, but he definitely should have been ready. The question is, had he been ready, what would that have meant? And the answer would have been maybe worse, frankly, because if the ships had to sail out of there, they would have taken a hit. But in due respect, they may have sank one or two Japanese carriers because the Japanese were expected to lose that many, and they didn't lose anything but 59 men, and they lost 20-some airplanes.
29 planes, and of course there were six fleet carriers, and later at Midway, Miracle at Midway, which you described so well, they lose four of their carriers, Akagi, Kaga, Soryu, and Hiryu, which really they never recovered from. And a lot of that was a credit to William Friedman and Joseph Rochefort, of our top U.S. naval cryptographers, who had a major role in regarding the Magic Intercepts. Give us our audience a little idea of what was Magic and what had Magic to do with Kimmel's claim.
Well, you see, Magic was modern to some degree, and it worked off of we were able to break it because Friedman, a Pittsburgher actually, and others had recreated the machine that the Japanese were using, and they had a system of ciphers and codes, and it's very complicated. Ciphers, you changed the things, they changed it every day. You had to have a signal like a baseball player. You hit his head, and the next play, tap your head, and the next play is going to be a steal or something. They had indicators. It's a very complicated thing that we were able to infiltrate with our genius and our brains to do this kind of stuff. But I wanted to go back to one quick thing. Japan in the 1930s was not Japan of today. Japan in the 1930s was a backward country where when they lost an aircraft carrier, it was devastating. We could build one a day in Tampa Bay, literally. At the end of the war, we're producing more than the Germans ever had. This is an arsenal of democracy. When the Japanese lost something, it was the end. This is not Japan of today. Japan of today can build things. Japan in those days couldn't. But in due respect, and this is important for Americans, 25 years later, the Japanese did it again. But instead of dropping bombs, they dropped Toyotas. Instead of shooting bullets, they shot yen. And we were surprised because we couldn't believe that they could do this. And now, of course, they're in trouble again. But this was 10 years ago. So we greatly didn't understand these people. But the code itself was important because once we knew what they were going to do, then we know it's like a quarterback. He's going to fake to the halfback, and he goes back to throw the ball. And you know that he's going to throw the ball, you don't go for the fake. But if you don't know the signal, he may give it to the halfback, and then you're in trouble. So by breaking the code, we knew when, where, how, and what they were going to do, and this really helped us greatly during the war.
Yeah. You know, most of the issues that were dealt with in the years directly after the war, it was generally accepted that FDR, who loved the Navy, would never let it be used as a sacrificial pawn involving us in World War II. And in fact, Grace Tully, his secretary, came into President Roosevelt in the day or so following the attack, the next day. And he was sitting in a dark room, basically weeping. I mean, this great strong man was so emotionally disturbed by this. And he said to her, "The American public will never forgive me for losing their fleet." And remember, the United States always was a small army, armed forces, but a great naval power. We had a great naval history from John Paul Jones, from, you know, those days, the Stephen Decatur, you know. So this was against Roosevelt's character. So in 1982, frankly, 100 years after the birth of Franklin Roosevelt, and 41 years after the attack, what inspired the late Gordon Prang, who had studied this with you and Kathleen Dillon, to write "At Dawn We Slept"?
Oh, man, this is a long story. Basically, Prang was a German historian. He had been in Germany in the 1930s. He's the first man, it's a book called Hitler's Words. It's still out there, to ever translate Hitler's speeches. When he got his PhD from the University of Iowa, he came, got a job at the University of Maryland, and while he was there, he joined the Navy, and he went to Japan, and he started working for General Douglas MacArthur. He got a 4-year leave of absence, and he worked with Douglas MacArthur, and he met all these Japanese people like Genda, Fujita, Watanabe, the guys that planned the attack, Chiaia, and they talked to him. They wanted to tell their story, and so he saw a chance to do this. So for 37 years, he began to collect this work and do it. It's a long story, but to make it short, he was like Virginia Woolf, Richard Burton character. He couldn't put it away. And just before he died, he turned it over to myself and Captain Dillon, who were former students. And we pushed it out, and very luckily, and the New York Times said we were good, and we got a bestseller out of it, and it changed our whole lives. It's more complicated than that, but he was in Japan. He saw all these people, and, you know, we always said, well, they didn't want it. They were proud of what they did, and with a little sake, and they'd sit around and talk about it. He was able to draw from these people what others had never been able to do, and now they're all dead, and so he's the only one that's really got the original ideas. Many of the Japanese documents that would have talked about the attack went down to sea at the Battle of Midway, so that the interviews were the only thing that we really had at that time. Mm.
And he, I mean, no matter how one looks at it, he's the primary. He spoke to the primary sources. He spoke to the people. This isn't a rumor mill. This isn't speculation. He discussed this right with these people, he knew where the bodies were buried, as it is said. You know, my guest is Professor Donald M. Goldstein of the University of Pittsburgh, professor emeritus now there, a long veteran of the Armed Forces of the United States, author of over 70 articles, 27 books. He's, in fact, I believe your last book is written about the famous Jimmy Doolittle and his remarkable career. Our subject today is the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, of course, and the revisionist myths about the attack and our vulnerability. You know, in the years right before and after the publishing of your book, there have been new critics of FDR and George Marshall with regards to the culpability of their leadership. People like Edwin Layton, Henry Clausen, Bruce Lee, others have written new books questioning everything about the attack. Professor Goldstein, what stimulated this spate of new charges, which came primarily after the publishing of the massive and authoritative At Dawn We Slept? Was this a political statement by these people?
A little bit, and it's also itself, you know, it sells books. I mean, and I give, God bless them, I give some of these people credit because, I mean, what they were trying to do was to delve into, the Japanese couldn't possibly have done this to us. We let them. I mean, that's always our feeling of the superiority. They couldn't do it. We let them do it, and it must have been that we let them do it. And you know, those are respected people. Now, if you check into, without getting into this too much, some of them had Japanese, the two books there, I don't want to mention the name because it's bad, had Japanese wives, and they knew Japanese culture, and they were trying to show that they, you know, a lot of people like to put the U.S. down. You know, I mean, when you're on top, you're the New York Yankees. By God, you guys take a hit. I mean, people in New York might like you, but the people outside, they want to see you get beat. The Pittsburgh Steelers want to see you get beat, and so consequently, this is not a good answer, but it is. It sells books. There's new material that comes out, and then what happens? Really, I have to go through this all the time. Is that people, out of context, take something that if you put it in context, for example, one guy said that there were messages in there that were sent in the congressional record that the Pearl Harbor, that the Japanese were coming. Yeah, those messages were in there, but when I went to track them, they weren't in there before the attack. They were put in there after the attack. They were never sent. And so what he did was, when he got the whole record, these messages were in there, and he's interpreting that the Japanese sent these messages, and we should have picked them up, that they were never really sent. They were added. And that kind of stuff. So
right.
it goes on and on.
Right. You know, just to review this, at Pearl Harbor, it was said that all the battleships were old enough to vote at Pearl during the attack, at the period of the attack. They were all raised from the mud surrounding Ford Island, except the, as you mentioned, the antiquated target ship Utah and the totally destroyed Arizona. Both were left as memorials to dead. Even the Oklahoma was refloated but never
right.
served. The rest, the Nevada, California, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Maryland, and Tennessee, were all refloated, all refitted, ready for service within a month to 6 months. The damaged destroyers, Cason, Downs, and even the Shaw, were eventually off to sea duty. And like their older big brothers, they served gallantly and earned battle stars from the South Pacific to Leyte to Normandy. The Japanese missed the big carriers, Saratoga and Lexington, failed to destroy the tank farms where all the naval and aviation fuel was stored, and the machine shops especially. If the tank farms would have been destroyed alone, the Pacific Fleet, even intact, would have been immobilized. With that in mind, was Pearl Harbor attack ultimately a tactical victory and a strategic mistake?
You hit it right on. It's a tactical victory. It was a strategic mistake because they picked on the wrong guys. We were bigger and faster and better, and we were going to, it's just a matter of if the game goes for four quarters, we're just going to pound the hell out of them. So they had to win fast. They had to get a big lead, which they did, but then they folded because they were a paper target, paper tiger. It was and the thing is, this happened even in, I'm an Air Force guy, and I flew, and I understand air power. But one of the myths of air power is that air power can win wars alone. You can't. You can't win without it, but by God, you have to go in there with troops. You have to occupy.
Boots on the ground.
The boots have to be on the ground. And even now, we still think we can win without it, but we can't. And what happened there at Pearl Harbor was they hit the wrong targets. Had they hit the oil, the POL docks and the dry docks, that would have set us back 6 months. They didn't have to sink the Navy. You can't sail if you don't have oil and gas, you know. And so what happens is that we'd had to go all the way back to San Diego, and the ships moved slow in those days. You didn't have the people forget that we didn't have these tankers that could fly and refuel and get there in a day or two. It would take a week or two and to refuel, and the tankers weren't that big. You're right on. What won the war in the Atlantic, ironically, was we knocked out their barbarian plans. Right. Oh, yes, we bombed them into submarines at Bremen. Oh, yes, we had firebomb raids and et cetera. But in the final analysis, what killed them was that they couldn't get the little old barbarian. I really mean it. And the oil in Pulaski and
right.
those places.
Schweinfurt, the raids on Schweinfurt. You know, in your view, if the Japanese attacked the Philippines, would we have declared war? And if we did, would our battleship-oriented fleet been capable of challenging the Imperial Japanese Navy in the open and vast waters of the Pacific?
One, we probably would have gone to war. Two, we probably would have been incapable. But in due respect, we're still going to win. We're going to win unless we quit. And we're going to win because we, and people, Lord is on the side of those with the most, it's hate to say that
right.
way, but we got the most. And we're going to win because this is not a great power. Japan is a little backward. It's hard to, and people forget, because they try to interpret history by today. And by today's standards, they try to interpret it. And you look at Japan today, although they don't have much of a Navy army because we do it for them, they are stronger. They can build things. What they make is good. They couldn't then. They hit the wrong guys, and we beat them. The only way they could beat us, and Yamamoto said this, was win the war in the Pacific, rather, hit Pearl Harbor, win the war down south and pick up the riches of the Dutch East Indies, et cetera, and then sue for peace. And there you hit it on the spot. They had every idea that maybe we would allow peace because why? Lindbergh, the New York, the newspapers, et cetera, were all talking about anti-war. They misread us. Pearl Harbor united this country like nothing's ever done before, even more than 9/11 because it affected the whole country. But the Japanese made that big mistake, and you hit it right hard there.
You know, we're running out of time, unfortunately, Professor Goldstein. We've covered everything. A quick answer. I only have a fraction of a moment left. In conclusion, will there one day be a consensus of what happened, or will there always be people wondering about who killed Lincoln? Was it Secretary of War Stanton, you know?
I think really that there never will be. As long as people are out there thinking, and that's good, they're challenging. They didn't bomb the Pentagon at 9/11. They didn't do this. They didn't go to the moon. You're right on. Amelia Earhart is still alive somewhere.
Right.
Kennedy again, who killed Kennedy, how was he killed? These things will always stay, and it's probably good that that happens. The public, though, and this is the important thing, is yes, that's good, but don't take things out of context. Remember, you got to be prepared because it usually happens, and I'm sure there'll be other Pearl Harbors or other attacks like that because it's very, very hard to be prepared.
Thank you, Professor Goldstein. It was an informative day. Have a good trip. I know you're be in Hawaii, and thank you very much. If you want, thanks. It's been a pleasure having you on. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be hosting my annual Sports Roundup program with Alan Rosenberg, Bruce Fabricant, Bob Troopin, a newcomer, former Assemblyman Ron Tochi will be focusing on Penn State scandal and every other thing that's gone on in sports. Thank you again, Professor Goldstein.
Thank you for having me, sir.
My pleasure. Be well. Bye-bye.